Peter B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, July 26, 2019. I've got news and comment for you today. It's a little confusing. The Democrats are sending very mixed signals about what they plan to do after the appearance of St. Bob Mueller before twin House committees this week. Jerry Nadler, who is the humorless, and I say that because I've interviewed him several times and I cannot get the guy to crack a smile, he's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and he appears to be developing a conflict with Speaker Pelosi after the hearing where he was able to prod Bob Mueller into saying yes to a series of statements that Nadler then uses to claim that he's got enough evidence to move forward on some sort of impeachment inquiry. But Pelosi has the brakes on. The parking brake and the regular brakes. And while she makes some comments hinting at, you know, if we see it, we'll pursue impeachment, Nadler filed a brief today arguing that he needs to see the grand jury materials from the Mueller investigation in order to decide whether to recommend articles of impeachment against the president. Now, is he tiptoeing toward impeachment, or is this a head fake designed to appease people like me who want to see the Democrats do their duty and pursue impeachment of this president? Or is it a way of buying time? Because next week, Congress will embark on a lengthy vacation. They won't be back until after Labor Day. And that means we have, 14 months until the 2020 elections. And as media pundits declare that impeachment is dead, I think many people are accepting that as a likely outcome. But Nadler wrote, referring to the part of the Constitution that gives Congress the power to impeach and remove a president, quote, to do so, the House must have access to all the relevant facts and consider whether to exercise all of its full Article I powers, including a constitutional power of the utmost gravity, recommendation of articles of impeachment. So the divided Democrats continue to dither. And let me say that their fundamental calculation is that by giving Trump a pass and just hoping that voters reject him in November of 2020, that Democrats will hold on to their majority in the House and Pelosi will remain Speaker for an additional 2 years. And I think that's a really risky bet. Just what we've seen in the last 2 weeks of Trump's assault on the squad, claims that they are racist, that they are anti-Semitic. His poll numbers are going up. His base loves this shit. And he's not going to cut back. He's not going to restrain himself. Unless, I believe, he's fighting for his political life through the impeachment potential. And it's possible that Pelosi is so stealthy and calculating that she wants this to blossom starting in September, and that she's going to time it so that the House returns its what is essentially an indictment of the president before the 2020 November elections, but without enough time for the Senate to take up action. That is one possibility. But I think part of that is wishful thinking on the part of your humble host. Now, there are members from these districts that the Democrats won last fall, 2018, and they believe that the voters will turn them out if they support impeachment. So one track that is being considered is for the Judiciary Committee to declare itself an impeachment committee without requiring a full vote of the House, so that these Democrats or conservadems who've been elected from swing districts, purple districts, or even red ones, won't have to take a position on it. But that means that Republicans don't have to take a position on it either. The Mueller hearing led five more Democrats to support impeachment, including Kathleen Clark, who is part of the House leadership team. But zero Republicans have expressed even, even a second thought. So I want to be clear that I recognize the difficulty of this. It's a Hobson's choice. Do you do the right thing and pursue an investigation leading to impeachment of Trump at the risk of your political caucus and its future? Or do you try to play it safe and hope that voters will allow the Democrats to continue to control the House? Now, with the exception of the budget deal that I'll talk about here shortly, the Democrats have passed a lot of legislation that makes Democrats feel good. But it doesn't go anywhere. The Senate is Trump's backstop, and even when there has been rare bipartisan support, like on the resolutions related to the war in Yemen, Trump has enough room that he can veto those without being overridden. So here's Friday's New York Times front page headline: Mueller hearing reinforces split on impeachment. Democrats are divided. That's very true. The Times says Nadler has gradually become convinced that his panel should proceed with impeachment hearings and do so as expeditiously as possible, but he hasn't stated that publicly. And Nancy Pelosi, in a caucus meeting, she said that, I do kind of not feel too comfortable when people say, if you care about the Constitution, you would be for impeachment. If you're not for impeachment, you don't care about the Constitution. Thank you very much. We all do. Now, I don't think that's a very meaningful statement. And I do understand what her calculations are. But given that there's no guarantee that the Democrats can hold the House in November of 2020, Trump could do some blistering tweet storms the week before the election and do enough to turn the tide. It is very difficult to predict how the House will go in a contentious, highly divided presidential election cycle. And that is the risky bet that I do not agree with. Matt Taibbi captured a lot in his Rolling Stone column after the Mueller appearance. Start with the obvious, he says, as political theater. The Democrats' decision to put special counsel Robert Mueller under oath was a catastrophe. Jerry Nadler said he hoped the Mueller movie of the book of his report would not end up being a dud. And Adam Schiff, the House Intelligence Chair, added, "We want to bring Robert Mueller to life." And Taibbi responds, "They didn't. Mueller was lost from the start, unable to recall basic details like what fusion GPS is, or the meaning of collusion versus conspiracy, or the identity of the president who first appointed him, an acting U.S. attorney." He quotes David Axelrod, former Obama strategist, "This is very, very painful." Howard Feynman, "I don't know what the Dems were expecting, but this probably wasn't it." At the Washington Post, Paul Kane, quote, "No mincing words here. It's a bad morning for the pro-impeachment crowd." And Taibbi goes on to say that the main result of Wednesday's hearing was to lift the lid on a two-year media myth. He deplores how Mueller was turned into a literal religious icon, depicted as a steely lie detector on the cover of Time. Then he has just a series of one-word sentences: Batman, Superman, boyfriend, savior. That's why I call him St. Bob. And yet, through all this, Mueller barely spoke. And now we have learned from one of the former prosecutors, Glenn Kirshner, who has suggested Mueller had a health issue causing, quote, a dramatic difference in communicative abilities. So Mueller wasn't even up to the job, and of course you know that I don't believe he ever intended to do a thorough investigation. That's why we got the limited hangout result that has infuriated so many. And Taibbi closes with this. Since 2016, the Democrats have repeatedly snatched defeat from the jaws of victory in one improbable faceplant after another. This is just the latest disaster. They hyped Robert Mueller for 2 years as an all-conquering hero, only to have him show up under oath like a man wandering in traffic. Incredible. The losses continue. The Democrats are pursuing a new thread that was highlighted by Mueller, that the written answers that Trump gave to questions submitted by the investigators included lies. I was going to use a euphemism, but, you know, that they were untruthful. And, you know, that may produce something. But without the will to pursue impeachment, I believe that the Democrats are simply going to continue to argue with each other. Now, on the heels of Mueller's appearance, the Senate Intelligence Committee, in what was described as a bipartisan report, although I don't have a vote that actually reflects that, they issued a report, and the headline in the New York Times uses the word combed. That is not a a technical term. Quote, Russia combed voting systems in all 50 states. So this report comes out, heavily redacted. And we're supposed to believe what individual members of the Intelligence Committee tell us is in it. And the Times writes, while details of many of the hackings directed by Russian intelligence, particularly in Illinois and Arizona, are well known, the committee described, quote, an unprecedented level of activity against state election infrastructure, intended largely to search for vulnerabilities. It concluded that while there is no evidence that any votes were changed in actual voting machines, Russian cyber actors, quote, were in a position to delete or change voter data, end quote, in the Illinois voter database. The committee found no evidence that they did so. So this is a lot of hysterical commentary about a potential threat that was not realized in 2016. And let's put the Russians out of this for a minute. We are long overdue to secure our election infrastructure. It's as leaky as can be. It is vulnerable to hacking and manipulation and election fraud like we saw with the absentee ballots in the congressional race in North Carolina last year. But nobody talks about election fraud. Nobody talks about the insecurity of electronic voting machines like New Jersey, where they have no paper trail and no possibility of either auditing or correcting any inappropriate actions. And it all boils down to the simplicity of hand-counted fucking paper ballots. We don't need all these machines. We don't need online databases. But that is the system we have in place. It has been profited on by many American companies. It has been manipulated by many American actors. And for Mueller to offer these vague threats that Russia's at it again and maybe other countries too, Iran might be trying to manipulate Americans. And we live in a soup of disinformation at all times. We are disinforming ourselves more often than any outside actor can be found to be doing so. And last night, it reached just a new bizarre moment. Rachel Maddow, refusing to let go of the Russiagate narrative, trotting out presidential candidate, Democratic senator from Colorado, Michael Bennett. He's on the Intelligence Committee. He vouches for this bipartisan report. And I wrote down carefully what he said. He said that Russia attacked this democracy in a very fundamental way is now unassailable and in front of the American people. It will happen in 2020. We need to defend against it. I'm sorry, there is no public evidence of this Russian attack. And the diversion that's been used to explain away Hillary Clinton's loss, to cover up the voter suppression schemes of the Republicans that were successful. It's reflected as lower turnout of African Americans in 2016. That all gets just pushed to the side. So I mentioned that the House did manage to pass a budget bill. It's a two-year bill. The best part of it is that there won't be a government shutdown for at least 2 years. But it's a stinky package. If you care at all about the deficit, that's the annual number of red ink, or the long-term federal debt, this only makes things worse. If you care about the rampant militarism and the continued funding of the Pentagon, this is a disgusting budget. And yet, it passed the House with 16 Democrats voting no. I don't know who they are. Didn't look it up. And 132 Republicans voted against it, despite calls from the tweeter-in-chief for them to fall in line. And I want to recommend a piece that I've linked to by Bill Hartung. William Hartung is a longtime analyst of the defense industry with a critical eye. He says this new budget vastly overpays for the Pentagon. $738 billion for fiscal year 2020, $740 billion for the next fiscal year. Two of the highest budgets for the Pentagon and related work since World War II. These figures are higher than the spending at the height of the Vietnam and Korean Wars, more than the high point of the Reagan buildup of the 80s. And these numbers are only slightly less than the spending in 2010, when the United States had 180,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, nine times the numbers currently deployed. And Hartung notes that the biggest flaw in the recommendations for the Pentagon budget are the failure to face climate change. U.S. policymakers and Pentagon planners should spend less time spinning out scenarios for how to fight a war with China and more on figuring out how to cooperate with Beijing in coming up with a plan in heading off a climate catastrophe. That's also on the mind of Andrew Basevich, the retired Army colonel and history professor at Boston University, who wrote a piece this week for Tom Dispatch called The Great Reckoning. And it has some puckish elements to it. It's not a straightforward commentary that I'm accustomed to from Andrew Basevich. It's based on a premise of historians looking back at 2019, what he calls the Great Reckoning. And he notes that Americans are deeply invested in distractions. Basevich doesn't own a smartphone. He's critical of people who do, thinking that we distract ourselves with trivia over matters of substance. He also takes a swipe at our love for craft beer, small batch bourbon, farm-to-table restaurants, and fantasy football. But in doing so, he points up how we are ignoring, we're oblivious to the most critical issues before us. And he's no Trump supporter. But he doesn't mention Russiagate in here at all or Bob Mueller, and I gave him a lot of props for that. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Andrew Basevich.
Well, and I don't want to be unfair to our fellow citizens, but I do think that there probably is more attention paid to craft beer and all these fancy bourbons and betting on sports games than to critically important issues that really demand that we should get serious about modifying the American way of life in order to ensure the sustainability of the planet and in order to demonstrate that we care about our grandchildren enough that they will have a planet that is livable. And there's nothing wrong with craft beer. But I think that our priorities are misplaced. And this is kind of a, half-joking way to point that out. Not that me writing about it is going to do any good. But you
can hear the full interview with Andrew Basevich. It's available today at peterbcollins.com and most of our outlets, including iTunes, whatever Apple calls that now. TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher. And I encourage you to take a listen. Also, I've linked to an article that was posted after
Well, actually, I found out about it after I interviewed Professor Basevich, and it's an article he wrote that's at the Spectator, and also I picked it up at another website, too. And it's entitled The Diplomacy of Deference. And while I believe that he understates his case, he does point that the Iran tensions will only be resolved with U.S. consensus provided from the Saudis and Israeli leaders. He writes, "It is manifestly the case that the U.S. today will undertake no action regarding Iran that Saudi and Israeli leaders find objectionable. By most measures, the U.S., the most powerful nation on the planet, wielding more power than Iran or Saudi Arabia or Israel. Yet in this circumstance, power doesn't translate into freedom of action. As a practical matter, the policy options available to the U.S. in the Persian Gulf are constrained by what Saudi and Israeli leaders are willing to tolerate." Now, I think the flip side is true, and that's not addressed by the professor. And that is that if the Saudis and the Israelis are eager for us to attack Iran, well, on a bipartisan basis, the U.S. has a hard time saying no. So I think it's an interesting piece, some of which he reflected in his discussion with me in the podcast today. And my work here is supported by people like you who sign up for subscriptions, $5 or $10 a month, the $50 annual. And that includes Suzanne Bowen, Paul Karsh, Aidan McAleer, and our good buddy Del Leonard, who's our vice president for marketing for New England. And I invite you to follow their admirable behavior. Log on to peterbcollins.com and set up your own subscription. Just click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. You hit the sign-up page, and you can make a choice in just a couple of minutes. Also, related to Iran, a much more direct, blunt, and critical analysis comes from my pal Pepe Escobar, published today at consortiumnews.com. And he says that Trump's comment this week that he could end the war in Afghanistan and wipe it off the face of the earth in a week reflects the warped logic, ordering a nuclear first strike as one orders a cheeseburger, and he notes that it could apply to Iran instead of Afghanistan. And Pepe Escobar, who is a globe-trotting expatriate of Brazil, notes that his native country under the new leader Bolsonaro is supporting U.S. sanctions and even going beyond, because there are two Iranian ships loaded with corn stranded off the coast of southern Brazil because the oil company of Brazil, the state energy company Petrobras, afraid of U.S. sanctions, refuses to refuel them. And Escobar points out that blockading food is illegal. And his Beltway sources confirmed that the highest level of U.S. government gave the order for Brasilia to stop this food shipment. And he closes his column by saying, "Iran has always been perfectly capable of protecting the Pentagonese Holy Grail, freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. Tehran certainly doesn't need former colonial powers to enforce it. It's so easy to lose the plot. The current alarming escalation is only taking place because the art of the deal obsession on imposing an illegal total economic war on Iran." Well, there's a heat wave across Europe. Lots of places are broiling here in the United States. But it looks like things, not the weather, are going to get very hot and tense in Hong Kong this weekend. So, you know, earlier this week, there were a group of thugs allegedly connected to the triads who came out and beat protesters, including those who had put graffiti on the Beijing government's liaison office in Hong Kong. That appears to be the step too far for Beijing. So, protesters applied for a permit for a march on Saturday in the town of Yuenlong, which is where the thugs beat up people, including innocent folks who'd just gotten off a train. They have been denied the permit. And so today, as I sat down to talk to you, it's reported that thousands of people have gathered at Hong Kong's airport, Kai Tak. I think they believe that's a safer location. I'm not sure why. And in the coverage in the New York Times, they coupled it with an article about how the People's Liberation Army, loyal to Beijing, has some 6,000 to 10,000 troops who are billeted in Hong Kong. Here in the U.S., an important court ruling that came from the formerly liberal Ninth Circuit based in San Francisco, but meeting in Pasadena, a three-judge panel, overturned a conviction based on one element of our immigration laws. Gets a little complicated, but what's important here is that the decision, the opinion, was written by Judge Jay Bybee. You remember him? Bush had him at the Office of Legal Counsel, and Bybee wrote opinions, like John Yoo, favorable to the torture policies of the Bush administration. And so Jay Bybee got a lifetime appointment to the Ninth Circuit. So in the decision, he said that related to immigrants who are accused of eluding officers, that can only apply to immigrants who come to a valid border crossing and then try to sneak through. And they overturned the case of Horacio Corrales Vasquez, a Mexican national, who they found hiding in the bushes miles from the border. And this is central to the convictions that led to family separation last year. And so if those cases are overturned, the Trump administration has no legal leg to stand on for the family separations and the deportations in many cases of one of the parents of a child who was left alone. Today there was a meeting and a photo op between the Speaker of the House and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The photo's been tweeted out, and we have a single quote from Pelosi. "We have our differences, but we're still a family." She acknowledged some personality issues, although she described them as minor. Now, the New York Times said that AOC went to the Speaker's office, quote, "trying to make amends." But since they offer no quote from AOC or a spokesperson for her, that appears to be pure speculation by Cheryl Gay Stolberg. And I resent that. There's an interesting piece by the religion writers of the Washington Post today examining how Trump's attacks on AOC and the Squad, claiming that they're anti-Semitic, how does that play with Jews in America? Well, they note that Trump's initial call for the Squad to go back where they came from struck many Jews as transparently prejudiced in a way that's all too familiar to them as members of a minority group. Then when he added that the four should apologize to America and Israel for the horrible, hateful things they've said, the Squad is very racist. He called Omar an American-hating anti-Semite. Well, many Jews that they contacted condemned Trump, saying he is using them as a political football to score points and to play one minority group off against others. And the comments include whether criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism are the same, or whether right-wing anti-Semitism, which many feel Trump has ignored, is more dangerous than the left-wing movement that's critical of Israel. And at least they parse it that criticism of Israel is not necessarily anti-Semitic. So I think it's an interesting piece. I don't agree with everything that's in it, but I think it is worthy of your attention if you have a moment or two. Bernie Sanders' campaign is pushing back on a network that has been grossly unfair. And it's not Fox. We're talking about MSDNC. I've linked to the story at Common Dreams, which includes quotes of many of the objectionable remarks made by people appearing on MSNBC. And there's a video clip that didn't come from the Sanders campaign, but that has, we'd call them lowlights, of MSNBC commentary.
Can I bring up the donkey in the room?
Bernie?
No!
Bernie Sanders makes my skin crawl.
But Sanders fading is a bigger story than people have given her credit for.
The previous set of numbers about Kamala Harris seems to suggest that Bernie bros are actually a real thing.
He's just waving his arms around, talking about revolution and all, where we are going, we won't need roads. I mean,
one of the things I always hear from folks who aren't necessarily on the Bernie bus, so to speak, is that he's not really a Democrat.
So you can listen to this if you wish. The link is there at peterbcollins.com in the show file for today's podcast. I also want to note and recommend that you read a piece by Caitlin Johnstone published earlier this week, Eight Thoughts on Marianne Williamson, because she is often derisively portrayed or just ignored. And let me concede that 20 years ago, I was approached by a publicist for Marianne Williamson offering an interview with her about her latest book. And I took some pleasure in turning it down because I viewed Marianne Williamson as just another new age woo-woo nut. And then I heard Marianne Williamson speak. And she changed my mind. She is a serious person. She has an array of ideas that, while I don't think they make her electable, they make her interesting. And they make her candidacy, I think, worth examining. And as Johnstone points out in one of her eight bullet points, Williamson holds a lot of bad positions as well. But she overarchingly offers a real progressive vision for a different America. And many people just reject her out of hand. And I'm not asking you to vote for her or even give her a dollar. But read Johnstone's piece and see what you think. Donald Trump has been rebuffed because Sweden tells us that ASAP Rocky is not above the law, and Trump's intervention will not produce his release. Now, we know there was a fight on the streets of Stockholm when Rocky was there for a rap concert on the 30th of June, and he claims it was self-defense, but the prosecutor says they've looked at all the facts and they're bringing him to trial next week. Meanwhile, others are tweeting back against Trump, who claimed that he's done so much for Sweden. And they said, we follow the rule of law. And what is it that you do for us, Mr. President? And finally, we learn the details of who created that phony, satirical presidential seal that popped up on Tuesday at an event by Teen Student Action Summit. So somebody from that organization went to the internet, grabbed this presidential seal where one of the eagle's quiver of arrows is replaced by presidential golf clubs. And then there is the phrase, the motto is replaced with Spanish for 45 is a puppet. Now, this was displayed behind the president as he spoke, and he was oblivious to it. We learned that a graphic designer from Virginia created this. His name is Charles Lizot, and he made it back in 2016. He put it on a website that's since gone dormant. He forgot all about it, and he couldn't have been more thrilled when he got the news that his phony presidential seal was being displayed at an authorized Trump event. I think there's an advance man who's about to lose his gig. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. Have a good weekend. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.